This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Then our flight from reality and from the ideals of our founders will get this globe of ours torn to hot flinders spinning gases. To us citizens of Green Prairie, this promise of inferno poses a simple question. What new folly can you dream up with your coffee, your grapefruit, your first cigarette to keep yourself a while longer from facing the truth?
While we were fed news about a new pope and the economic breakdown on the little island of Cyprus, a major event occurred almost unreported in the Arctic. It's a very bad sign. Let's go to Paul Beckwith. He's the PhD student and part-time professor of climatology and meteorology at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul is also a member of AMEG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, how are you today, Alex?
Well, I'm doing okay. We're going to talk about the weather, I guess, as we get going here. I want to ask you first, though, what happened in the Arctic sea ice in the winter of 2013 that caused you so much concern?
Well, I think a lot of people, or most people, are aware of the massive melt, the record melt, which ended September 15th of 2012, and some of the reasons behind that rapid melting. And basically, the ice, you know, it reforms in the winter months as the sun drops below the horizon. However, this year, because there's kind of a memory effect, there was so little ice in September last year that the ocean water has warmed significantly, so it took longer for the ice to form. And there's not a lot of multi-year ice. It's mostly first-year ice that's formed. And the ice seems to be very thin and very slushy, not very strong. And then come, February, sort of early February, March, I think the ice formation was the strongest about mid-March or so. Although from February to March, there were significant cracks developing in the ice. The whole thing does move, but it didn't seem to have structural integrity this year. Normally, when the ice breaks up, it kind of, as the melt season starts, it kind of melts around the edges and decreases. But this year, the whole pack is basically shattered into pieces with many fractures and many small chunks and stuff. It's like a regime change in the way the ice melts.
And you sent me a video that looked like a big vortex swirl at the top of the world there. Was there a storm or something?
Yes, there was a, I believe it was about mid-January, there was a phenomena called a sudden stratospheric warming. And what happened is that the jet streams where they cross the Himalayas in Asia, they went more vertical than normal, and they carried a lot of air from the troposphere into the stratosphere. And that air went up into the Arctic and came down, and it basically shattered the Arctic polar vortex. So what that meant, because the Arctic is warming much faster than the rest of the planet, the jet stream is basically slowing down and becoming wavier. And when the sudden stratospheric warming event occurred, it basically sliced the jets. So there was a huge high-pressure ridge across the Arctic. And basically, the jets normally confine cold air to the Arctic, and it's warmer air further south. But because they were disrupted, we basically had a leak of cold air out of the vortex into southern latitudes. So, for example, Britain had their coldest spring in, 50 years, or maybe it was 100 years. And the Arctic is much warmer than normal, and further south it's much colder than normal. So there's been a complete disruption of the climate system over the last several months, and it's still continuing.
Right. I mean, people in the UK, Germany, Eastern Europe, they'd love to have some more global warming right now. The nasty winter they just had. In Ottawa, you just got snow in the middle of April. So you think the Arctic is partly to blame for this weird weather?
Yes. I think people need to kind of change their frame of mind on what is happening. You know, in the past, climatologists and meteorologists have always said there's a distinct separation between the two fields, and you can never attribute a particular weather event to climate. But what's happening is the climate system the atmosphere ocean system has changed, so the background has changed. So therefore, everything is off the table in terms of our previous thinking. You know, we need to think of, you know, when the background climate system is different than weather events that occur, whether it's frequency of extreme events, duration of extreme events, spatial location of extreme events, all that can change. So the Arctic has a huge impact on, certainly on Northern Hemisphere weather, but also it extends into the Southern Hemisphere. There's linkages to the Southern Hemisphere as well. Like, for example, to the growing sea ice in Southern Hemisphere winters. That can be related, too, because the Arctic is warming from increased absorption of sunlight because the albedo is collapsing. So basically, the sea ice decline and the snow cover decline is making it a darker. The average reflectance of the Arctic region is lower, so there's more sunlight being absorbed, so we're getting heating. Very high relative heating there compared to the equator, which decreases the temperature gradient, which makes the jet stream slow and go away there. So there's less need for heat to move from the equator up north via the atmosphere and ocean current. So more heat moves to the southern hemisphere. And because Antarctica is kind of isolated, the temperature gradient, so the southern hemisphere is warming because more heat is being carried down there, but that heat can't make it past the large circumpolar ocean currents and atmospheric jets in the southern hemisphere. So it increases the temperature gradient and increases the speeds of those winds, which causes cooling on the surface of Antarctica, which causes the increase in the sea ice there. And also the sea ice is melting, so there's a layer of sort of a lens of fresh water under the ice, which is disrupting the vertical mixing of the ocean. So then we get into things like the meridional ocean circulation patterns, and those are also being affected by what's going on. So you need to consider various aspects of the system to get a good picture. I mean, there's a lot of different components, and most people, you know, most scientists haven't come to grips yet with the extent of the changes.
Well, as you know, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, has just released a study predicting the Arctic will be almost ice-free in the next decade or two. Their work is published online in Geophysical Research Letters, and it says the event is no longer a matter of if, but when. How soon do you think it could happen?
Well, first, a little bit about that NOAA work. They used their models, right, and the model still said 2050. So then they went and they looked, they kind of tweaked their models and came up with the 2030 number. And then looking at the actual data as opposed to the models, they came up with their 2020 number. But if you look at the PO mass, the volume data, it basically showed that there was a 5% chance of 2013 having no sea ice in September at the end of the melt season, 50% chance with 2015, and greater than 95% chance with 2018. Now, based on the behavior of the sea ice over the winter, and based on this new regime of cracking and weakening of the ice, you know, at the time of the year when the ice should be the strongest, which is March, right, at the end of the freezing season, I think that there's a very high probability that the ice could completely vanish from the Arctic by this September. What it would require for that to happen is if there were, last year, there were some very extensive duration, very powerful cyclones that churned up the sea ice, broke it up into small chunks, which increased the surface area and increased the melting. It also ripped large pieces of ice off and sent it to lower latitudes where it melted. And it also caused upwelling of warm water from below. There was vertical warm water was moving up from depths of 500 meters, which is very surprising to people. Also, you get a storm surge with a cyclone. And it was estimated that the storm surge was about a third of a meter. So when that water is being pulled up by the cyclone, then warm water has to go into the Arctic basin through the Bering Strait and also through the on the Atlantic side. And this warm water would also contribute to the melting. So there's all these factors. So when you incorporate all these factors, you know, we're obviously in a very abrupt regime change in the ice. So certainly I would say that the models are not the way to go. If you need to really look at the data and what's going on, and based on that, I think there's a good chance that this year it could go, if not certainly in the next year or two. So the NOAA stuff is getting, I think it's getting closer to reality, but I don't think it's quite there yet. I think they're still going to get surprises from what they're saying.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Paul Beckwith, a climate scientist at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, you've joined other scientists like the Cambridge Arctic specialist Dr. Peter Wadhams and concerned activists in AMIG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Is this really an emergency, and what is new with AMIG?
It's interesting because AMIG basically started, it was about November 2011. I think there was a small conference, a small group of people that got together and decided to form the group because they were so concerned about the rate of decline of sea ice in the Arctic and other things, the methane coming up in particular. I found out about the group December 2011 and joined. And, you know, over the last year and a half, I mean, we've met various politicians. We've tried basically to educate people, alert people to the rapidity of changes in the system with the sea ice, with methane emissions greatly increasing, and so on. Now, Peter is, he's sort of a hands-on scientist. He's been on many submarine trips under the Arctic sea ice measuring thicknesses. He's been doing it for 30-plus years. So there's not too many people that know more about the ice, sea ice than him. And, you know, we're all sort of on the same line of thinking that it's happening very, very quickly. So he and some other AMIG people in Britain went in the British Parliament. I did it in the Canadian Parliament. But they went, and the British Met Office has a lot of pull, and they went and spoke to British Met Office people and said what was going on. And they were basically, people didn't want to believe the message that was coming out. So it was kind of discounted, and the Met Office had the view that, you know, the models are correct, it's going to be 2050, 2070 time frame. But what's happened in Britain with having the record, the coldest spring, because of the very strange jet streams and, you know, from the lack of sea ice, that they've, just in the last week, they've kind of changed their tune. And Julia Slingo, the head scientist there, has called a meeting of world experts on sea ice and to get them all together to find out what's going on. Because she's obviously the type of weather that's resulting in Britain has been a huge problem. I saw a report that said that in the morgues, the mortality rates have jumped very, very high in the last several months because of this coldness. In fact, I saw numbers, you know, greater than 5,000, 10,000 people. So the number being killed above and beyond the normal mortality rate, mostly pensioners and older people. I mean, some of the homes in Britain don't have proper heating. They don't expect that. So, you know, this hasn't, the final count and the final numbers on this haven't come out. But this is, you know, very, very concerning stuff, you know. And of course, the U.S. drought. I mean, if NOAA also said that the U.S. drought, they didn't think it was connected too much to what's going on, but I don't see how they can get that conclusion. I mean, we know that the heat wave in Russia and the flooding in Pakistan was just the these stuck jet stream patterns. So it's affecting people now. Food is going to be a big issue. I mean, there has been warnings from the UN and other people about food supply problems even later this year or next year.
Yes, some of these warnings published in the British papers say millions will die from food shortages due to climate change. Well, now I want to ask you, Dr. Ken Caldera is a top-ranked atmospheric scientist with the Carnegie Institution. He's been an IPCC lead author. Caldera is calling for emergency action to cool the Arctic by spraying aerosols into the atmosphere. Is Ken a member of AMIG, and do you agree this is necessary?
I don't believe that Ken is a member of AMIG, but this idea of the necessity of cooling the Arctic, sort of regionally cooling it, to buy a bit of time for us to slash emissions, you know, it's kind of a choice. I mean, do we just let the Arctic melting proceed? Because what you have to remember is that the sea ice in the Arctic provides air conditioning to the Northern Hemisphere. It takes an awful lot of energy. Like, for example, let's say you supply 1 unit of heat to 1 gram of ice, and it melts that ice. Well, the next unit of heat, you know, the same unit of heat that you apply to that water will warm that water 80 degrees Celsius. So that's the type of thing. So as long as you have ice there, the heat is going into melting the ice. When the ice is gone, the heat is going into warming it. And like I say, that 1 gram of water will warm 80 degrees. So when the sea ice is gone, then the warming will greatly accelerate. And then we have to really worry about the cascading effects on methane emissions and also on Greenland. I mean, Greenland is not doing very well. West Greenland, most of the snow covering the ice has already melted. And I've been checking the temperatures in Newark, Greenland, and those temperatures are about the same as Ottawa. The highs each day for the last 3 weeks have been above zero, between, you know, about 5 degrees C or something, the highs. The lows are close to zero or a couple of degrees below. But this is very unusual, and this was due to a high-pressure ridge that was sitting over Greenland. So there's a lot of melt already on the surface of Greenland, and it's very early. So AMEG's been pushing for some regional cooling via geoengineering. The quickest way to do it, and the way that we know most about, is through sulfur dioxide in the stratosphere, just right over the Arctic region in the summer to cool that particular region.
Well, some scientists have doubts about this kind of geoengineering, saying it could have unforeseen consequences. You mentioned the UK Met Office. Jim Haywood of that office just wrote in the journal Nature Climate Change, such fine particles sprayed into the atmosphere could increase horrible droughts in the Sahel region of North Africa. Have you read about that?
Yes. I mean, the Sahel is a very sensitive region because the intertropical convergence zone, which sort of travels around the equator, you know, very moist air, it kind of fluctuates around that region. So if it's a little bit too far south, it's drought there. And if it's, you know, where it's supposed to be, then the region is still marginal in terms of water. So what they did is they looked at rainfall and droughts in that region with volcanoes going off, because when big volcanoes go off, they can inject sulfur dioxide and ash up into the stratosphere and affect the climate. So they looked at El Shaishan, which was 82, 83, Mexico. They looked at Pinatubo in 91. They also looked at, I think it was Aguada in 1815. Now, the thing about volcanoes and their effect on the climate is it really depends on the latitude of the volcano. So the Mexican one and the Indonesian one in 1815, those ones were very close to the equator. So it really depends on the latitude. So putting the sulfur dioxide at the North Pole, or, you know, in the far north, it has quite a big difference than putting it, having it closer to the equator.
Well, fair enough. Now, Paul Beckwith, you must be aware, even talking about this will trigger another popular internet meme that governments have been secretly spraying materials into the atmosphere for years. It's the chemtrail conspiracy theory. What do you make of that?
Well, I've always been very skeptical of that because I haven't seen... I mean, I have tried to read and see if there was a lot to it. And like, for example, one of the claims is that if you're spraying stuff into the atmosphere, then you have to be able to detect it in the soils and so on. And I have seen a study that showed there was some aluminum and barium and higher levels. Yeah, I don't know if it was really confirmed or whether it was just, you know, one particular study. I mean, you kind of have to ask, if stuff is being sprayed, then why is it being sprayed? I mean, if it's being sprayed to cool the planet, then, you know, that's the problem, because it's not working, right? So, you know, one of the things is, because the atmosphere is warmer, because we've warmed the planet about 0.8 degrees in the last 100-odd years, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. In fact, there's about 4% more water vapor in the atmosphere than there was even 30 years ago. So what this could mean is that there's more contrails from aircraft and they last longer because there's more water vapor in the atmosphere. But I've seen some of the satellite images of the crisscross trails over cities and things, and it is a question. But, I mean, if they're spraying, then there has to be instrumentation on aircraft. Like, surely people could investigate this and come up with, you know, absolute proof for if it is being done. And I haven't seen that, so...
Yeah, I mean, if there had been thousands of flights and thousands of people involved in it, somebody would have blurted it out. You can't keep a secret for decades.
No,
that,
you can't.
That's happening. But we do have to admit that governments are openly involved in some kinds of climate modification. Just look at the efforts by China, for example, to seed clouds during their drought in northern China. And the U.S. military has published documents about using weather as a weapon of war. Maybe we are already modifying the weather a little bit.
Yes, and I mean there's also a lot of reports about this HARP, which is basically using phased array radar sites to like kind of focus energy up into high atmosphere of the stratosphere to ionize particles, to ionize molecules and things and create these ions to, you know, I'm not sure what they're actually studying, but you know, I played around on Google Earth for, you know, a while back, and you could actually find different things that look like phased array antennas from Google Earth. So, you know, what are they using these things for? I mean, we know that these programs do exist. You can find some government stuff, but there's almost no information that you can get on these things. So, again, quite often, you know, there tends to be some truth behind some of these very persistent sort of long-term things. Although I think that Barack Obama was a U.S. citizen. He was born in the U.S.
Well, we can laugh about it. I think that the military people, or some of them anyway, with HARP would like to be able to send a storm over an enemy if they could, but I think it's premature to say that they're doing anything at this point, and that's just my opinion, and it's pretty hard to tell. But the real kicker in all this, Paul, is that humans are geoengineering the planet on a vast scale right now. You and I help to do it when we turn on the ignition in our cars. It's not about whether we should change the weather. We have changed the weather, and everybody knows it.
Yeah, exactly. And the amount of sulfur, I mean, we have smokestacks all over the planet on power plants, and when we burn coal, they have high concentrations of sulfur. So, you know, the amount of sulfur going up into the atmosphere right now from our power plants, I mean, that far exceeds, I mean, the amount required to inject up in the stratosphere in the Arctic, for example, is minuscule compared to the amounts that we're putting in with our unplanned, you know, I mean, these are side effects of our society, right, of our industry. We have been geoengineering. I mean, when people first cut down trees and converted it to cropland, I mean, everything has an impact. It's just, you know, what's the magnitude of the impact? And when you talk about more and more people on the planet doing this sort of thing, the cumulative impact gets larger and larger, of course.
I'm Alex Smith, and I'm talking with the very well-informed Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa in Canada. Paul, for the record, and for listeners, I do oppose geoengineering at this point. I think we're too stupid to manage it and will likely make things worse. But on the other hand, as you say, if we just sit back and let this polar ice cap disappear, mass extinctions, including our own, seem likely. I don't see a good choice. Well, one thing that amazes me is the video you posted on the Sierra Club blog. It reappeared at elephantjournal.com, but can't compare with crazy cat videos for public attention on the net. I mean, Kim Kardashian's better known than what's happening in the Arctic. So what do you think? Are we just going to let this happen?
I think that people are starting to wake up. You know, like a global crop failure causing prices to spike up, you know, not just double, triple, quadruple, something like that would do it. I think if the sea ice is completely gone in September of this year, that will do it. I mean, I think we're getting close to a tipping point or an abrupt change in human behavior on this, because it can't be hidden. Like, you can't, you know, you can't have some corporation or some group of people spending millions of dollars to convince the public that this is not happening. I mean, you can, I think a lot of people are starting to feel, you know, there's something wrong. I just saw a report yesterday. I think they had 17 inches of snow, you know, April 15th in the mid US. So it's quite far south. Like, so one weather event, yeah, you can't say it's really climate change. That's the traditional way of thinking. If you change the whole background system, I mean, Jim Hansen has done a lot of statistical studies, and basically you're shifting the bell curve. I mean, the weather happened under this bell curve, and what you're doing is shifting the average to a higher temperature, and you're shifting the shape of the bell curve, so you're getting a lot more events, you know, at the extremes. So statistically, it's changing. And I think people are starting to get this feeling, you know, what the heck's going on, and starting to pay more attention to it. So that hopefully will lead to a price on carbon, like a fee and dividend is the ideal thing, right? You have a fee on carbon, but you have a dividend. So the money that you collect from the fee, none of that goes to the government. It all goes back to people, right? Allowing them to adjust their way of life so they use less fossil fuels and so on.
We're starting to run out of time, Paul. Is there anything else that you'd like to talk to us about?
I think it's important that people remember that this is a whole system, and there's lots of, you know, when you get down to the details of the system, the individual components, there's surprises, there's things you don't understand. But, you know, we're starting to, at least some of us are starting to get a better sort of feel for, you know, the whole picture. And we do have precedents for what's happened in the past. I mean, we have paleo records which show how quickly the temperature has changed from one state to another. So, and the models, if you talk to somebody and they say, oh, this isn't going to happen and I'm basing it on a model of the climate, then this is a real problem. Like, I'm very curious as to what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is going to do, because they produce their document. Their next document is due out either at the end of this year or early next year. And a lot of their projections and things are based on these models. And the models are broken for sea ice, and they're broken for emissions coming out. And they're, I mean, when I say broken, they're not predicting what's happening. So it'll be interesting to see. They have kind of a conundrum, because are they going to come out with a document? I mean, the sea ice could be gone in September, and then they'll have a document saying the sea ice will be gone in 2030 or 2040, right? Well, obviously, who's going to, you know, there's a problem there, right? So what are they going to say in their document? I mean, are they going to wait till they see what happens and then change their predictions? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, I mean, these documents coming out every 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, it doesn't make sense to operate that way. So I think they really need to rethink what they do and have, like, much more rapid response.
Well, I agree, and I have very low hopes for the coming publication from IPCC. I think that we are at an emergency point and that we need a full-time, fully paid group of scientists all over the world who are working in real time with what is happening and keeping us all up to date with it. You know, you can find Paul Beckwith's blog at sierraclub.ca and links to his articles, plus the papers we've mentioned in this interview, in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul is from the University of Ottawa in Canada. As always, it's been enlightening talking with you. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Please support this program and all our nonprofit radio stations. Your help makes it happen. Find a list of the 67 stations broadcasting Radio EcoShock at our website, ecoshock.org. Sign up for our worldwide weekly podcast. Please tell your friends about Radio EcoShock while there's still time to make the big change. Find Radio EcoShock on Facebook and get all the links and commentary for this show in my weekly blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll try it again next week, assuming there is a next week.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.